The Dubai thing hadn't worked according to plan, and he still had several law enforcement agencies looking for him as a result of the Grand Central Station fiasco. Things were closing in on him. Cash was good to have, but information might be just as good. Maybe better. You are a man with information, Doncor. How about your cash offer, plus some information I can use? But it better be good. Doncor shrugged and gave it a few moments of thought. Then his face lit up.
Well, I just might have some information.
Tell me. Zimler was expecting to get something about the local cops being alerted to his presence in Cairo, or Interpol agents nosing around. But what he heard was something different altogether.
Well, Doncor said, that American guy is not far from here right now. He's up in Israel, supposedly. Don't know why, just that he is meeting with the Israelis.
Zimler looked into Doncor's eyes. He stared him down. What American guy?
You know, Doncor said cautiously, the guy you were chasing down on the Damas job. The American.
Joshua Jordan?
Yeah, that's him.
Zimler's mind lit up like a kaleidoscope. A whole spectrum of possibilities lay before him.
Doncor, do you think you can get some more information on Jordan? Where he is right now?
Doncor nodded.
I think so, maybe. Yes. So do we have a deal for the diamonds?
Atta Zimler smiled and held out his hand to shake.
Of course. It's a pleasure doing business with you.
Chapter 40. At Hawk's Nest, Abigail Jordan was sitting with Victoria, Pac McHenry's wife, on the big wraparound porch. The perfectly coiffed platinum blonde in her late 50s said she was flying through Denver on the way to Los Angeles. She had an urgent message that she needed to deliver to Abigail in person, something from her husband Pac that had surfaced just after their recent visit together in Washington. Abigail had brought out some tea, but neither was drinking it yet. Abigail and Victoria had hit it off fabulously in D.C. when they had brunch together. Though Victoria never said it out loud, Abigail had assumed that she had experience in the clandestine services herself, just like her husband. It was implied in the way she talked. Her knowledge of national security issues and the agency lingo she used so proficiently. Just a hunch, but Abigail was sure she was right. Victoria asked,
"You're running things in the round table for the time being? Until Josh gets back. Pac speaks very highly of you. And of Josh, too.
Funny. Josh thinks the same about you and Pac. It's too bad our talks are always so crisis-driven, so little time for real conversation. That's why I enjoyed our lunch together."
When Victoria spoke next, there was regret in her voice.
"Well, Abby, I'm afraid we need to get down to brass tacks."
"I understand.
So, speaking of crises, you said you had a message?"
Victoria's expression changed. It was all business.
"Here it is. Pac says the most recent intel, and I am talking within the last 12 hours, is that we now know the targets and the general staging areas."
Abigail felt a nervous fluttering in her stomach.
"For the attacks?"
"Yes. Pac has filtered this information down the line to the right people in the federal agencies, but he wants to scream bloody murder because no one is listening. Or if they are, then their hands are tied."
Victoria paused before she delivered her caveat.
"This information is arguably classified. I emphasize arguably. Do you want to hear it? You know the repercussions. I know the consequences if we do nothing. Josh and I don't believe in sitting on the sidelines, so tell me what you can."
"The targets are New York and Washington, D.C. The staging areas are lower New York State, or possibly New Jersey, and Virginia, respectively. The nuclear devices are small enough to be transported by a medium-sized truck, much smaller than a semi.
And we're just a matter of days away. Pac is over in Paris right now, coordinating this information. He's getting this from one of the Russian republics, so that's what I know.
What can your people do?"
"John Gallagher, a former special agent for the FBI, is out on his own right now trying to turn up leads. We couldn't get a consensus from the roundtable for any specific funding."
"Did PAC's budget summary come through?"
"It did, and I sent it immediately to each member of the group. Josh and I are willing to put up some money.
Beverly Rose Cortez has personally pledged a boatload, but everybody's jittery. The Department of Justice is looking into our operations. You know what that means.
Victoria gave a look that let Abigail know they were on the same track. Victoria pushed her teacup away.
Before I go, I'll give you the account information and routing numbers to wire the money. Pack has lined up men, equipment, as much as he can, you know, to try to interdict these mass murderers, just in case the feds really do stand down on this. But this whole operation is off-ledger, so it has to be privately funded. Then Victoria added, and one more piece of data. According to Pack, the Russians said that the staging site for the Washington attack was, and this is a direct quote from surveillance, a blast from the past. Whatever that means. Abigail leaned back in her chair. She took a deep breath. This was no time for hand-wringing. Action needed to be taken. She said, I'm going to contact John Gallagher immediately and give him this information. This is frightening. Like a bad dream. We've got to stop this horror from happening. But everybody, everything is moving in slow motion. Do you have any family in D.C. or New York? You may want to get them out right now. No, thank goodness. We have a penthouse. No one's there. But, oh no, our housekeeper's still in New York. I'll need to find a reason to get her out of town. Cal is here with me and has a few more days before classes start up. And Deborah should be back at West Point by now. Abigail knew she was missing something in her thinking about her daughter, but she kept talking. How close is West Point to New York?
Dear Lord, it's only about 40 miles. I have to get her out immediately.
We have a condo in Manhattan, too. I'm out of town now until we find out what's happening. And Pack, of course, is over in France.
Abigail looked off to the mountains and drifted away for a second. Then she said,
You and Pack must spend a lot of time apart. Part of the deal, I guess. It gets a little easier with time. But it's never really easy. You try to manage, try not to become strangers. You work at loving each other to keep it together. And the pressure, of course, of what he does.
There was a catch in Victoria's voice. Abigail heard it. She reached over and squeezed her hand, and then found herself getting teary-eyed.
I do wish Josh was here. All this is overwhelming.
Victoria glanced at her watch.
Abby, dear, I have to go. Don't want to, but I must.
Abigail nodded and got up with her.
So, Victoria said, with Josh overseas, you're holding down the fort here.
I guess so. But I feel like the hostiles are closing in, surrounding the fort.
That doesn't sound like the person I've heard so much about, the woman with an invincible faith in God.
God's the invincible one. I wish my faith was unshakable. When I feel weak, vulnerable, that's when I just drop down before the Lord and claim His grace. I figure if He loves me enough to send His Son to save me, then He's more than able to direct me. I was raised a churchgoer, but Pack and I... That hasn't been part of our life. Some of his patriot group, they're like you, really into the born-again Jesus thing. It makes me think...
Victoria paused as if she wanted to say more, but she didn't. Instead, she gave Abigail a warm hug, a kiss on the cheek, and then headed to her rental car.
Abigail ran inside to call Deborah, then stopped in her tracks. In the stress of the moment, she had completely forgotten that Deb wasn't at West Point. A momentary rush of relief washed over her as she remembered that Josh had taken her to Israel with him. But just as quickly she had another thought. Was her daughter any safer in Israel?
Chapter 41
Gallagher was like a hunting dog listening for the whistle. He was straining to hear Abigail's voice on the phone over the sound of traffic. Blast from the past. Somebody in a Russian camp used that phrase.
Yes, Abigail said. Victoria was very precise about it. Maybe it means nothing, but I thought you ought to know.
Gallagher was still in Richmond. He had tried a few of his local FBI contacts, fishing for information, but came up dry. He'd been standing in line at an espresso shop, with coffee and baked goods in hand, when Abigail's call came. So he had to set the cup and bear claw down on a table and headed outside. To Gallagher, the assignments were clear. Okay. I'm in Virginia now, Abby. I need to know that Pat McHenry's folks can handle New York while I work the Washington angle from here.
I'll call Victoria. I don't think she's boarded yet.
Oh, and for what it's worth, ask Cal if he's got any brilliant information for me.
Cal?
Yeah, I hope it's okay. But I threw him a little research bone. He wanted something to do, so I had him look up some stuff for me.
John, I think Josh wanted to keep him out of this.
Gallagher smelled a family feud. Sorry, Abby. Hope I didn't interfere.
No, it's okay. Abby sounded upbeat. Bless you, John, for wanting to include him. I'll talk to Cal.
After they hung up, Gallagher called Ken Leary, who was back at his office. He was put on hold. Finally, Ken picked up. Ken, I need everything you've got on the plans of the old Soviet Guard and their plans for nuking the United States.
Gee, thanks. You got a warehouse or two?
I'll need them so I can fill them with everything we've got on that.
Really, John?
I don't want the entire history of the Cold War. We're talking the suitcase nuke scenario. I'm not an expert on Soviet stuff, but I'll see what I can do.
Just then, Gallagher's call wait light flashed on his all phone. He put Ken on hold and took the call.
John, this is Cal.
Right. Hey, I've got a call going here. Can this wait?
I don't know. I've got something interesting.
Interesting is not what I need. We're up against it here, Cal.
Well, you wanted research on Soviet plans for portable nukes inside the U.S. Well, this thing popped up.
Quickly.
Well, a former KGB agent wrote a book years ago about Soviet plans to hide nukes in Virginia.
Whoa! Hold up, cowboy. I'm going to loop someone in.
Gallagher clicked back to Ken Leary and said he'd patch him into a three-way, but reminded Ken that this would be a young civilian doing the talking.
Okay, Cal, keep going.
Well, the former KGB guy's name is Stanislav Lunev. He defected to the U.S. in 92. His book was published by Regnery in 98. He says the Kremlin had plans to plant nuclear weapons within driving distance of the capital in a remote area of Virginia.
Like where?
Shenandoah Valley.
Okay. Good work, Cal. You passed the test. Thanks. Now I gotta go. Good talking with you. Bye.
After clicking off with Cal, Gallagher went into his jackhammer routine with Leary.
Ken, get everything on this Lunev. See about the backstory. Get the debriefings.
I vaguely remember this guy.
Me too. Some of my compatriots at the Bureau thought he might be a master exaggerator, but this Shenandoah Valley stuff is news to me. Maybe this is the blast from the past that the Russians are talking about.
Ken Leary's voice went up an octave.
I think the debriefing interviews would be in the archives at the Counterproliferation Center at the agency. I'll need information about the places where the Russians scouted out nuclear hiding spots.
Exactly. Now go, go, go!
Gallagher clicked off and fished in his pocket for a prescription bottle. He popped a pill in his mouth. He'd finally given in to the doctor's orders to deal with his acid reflux. His chest was burning like a bucket of molten steel. Negev Desert, Israel. It was blistering hot in the rocky desert plains in southern Israel, not far from the border with Egypt. Joshua Jordan was with a team of Israeli ballistic experts and weapons physicists. Earlier in the day, they had arrived at an area marked by a tall stone obelisk with a warning in Hebrew and English, "Entrance forbidden." This was the IDF weapons testing range. Joshua and the missile defense team had just run through some tests for the return-to-sender system. One of the Israeli physicists approached Joshua.
Colonel Jordan, I have a concern about the ability of RTS to handle multiple warheads, and there's also that matter of the RTS failure in the Chicago flight.
Doctor, Joshua answered, about the commercial jet, we've repeatedly requested the accident data from the NTSB so we can evaluate it ourselves. They've refused to cooperate. So was there an RTS failure, or was it compromised by the pilot, by the airlines? Disengaged by a mechanic, we simply don't know.
As for the multiple warheads, the North Korean episode last year should answer that. RTS performed perfectly.
One of the weapons engineers shook his head.
We know you are required by the Pentagon to deliver a lower quality weapon to us. So what aren't we getting in this package? Will it compromise our ability to stop Iranian missiles?
Joshua dabbed the sweat from his neck. He took off his sunglasses and wiped his eyes. Pentagon protocol requires a slightly different weapons version for our international partners. Same capabilities, but the engineering guts are a bit different, for obvious reasons. We don't want anyone out there to be able to reverse-engineer our exact design. Rest assured that the RTS system will protect Israel. As we saw today, we're 10 out of 10 on the scorecard for the tests out here, and
What desert is this, Clint?
Colonel Clinton Kinney reminded him, Paran, where God brought Moses and the children of Israel after rescuing them from bondage in Egypt. He brought them here with a pillar of cloud to lead them. This became the staging area for their entrance into Canaan. One of the military officers chuckled.
You're forgetting something, Rabbi Kinney. A small matter of their wandering for 40 years in the wilderness.
Sure, Kinney said, because of their cowardice and disobedience. Gentlemen, I think we have to believe that God is able and will do what he has promised to protect Israel. When the flood comes, he will part the sea. When the missiles come, God will deflect them. When the armies roll toward us, he will shake the ground with thunder and scatter them. Let's hope, another IDF officer quipped, that God will make the RTS system work, because we all know that our nuclear capacity has been circumcised, said another officer, evoking laughter from the group. But beneath the laughter was the sobering realization that Israel, under crippling international pressure, had been forced to dismantle its own nuclear weapons system. Now the RTS system had an even higher value to this tiny nation surrounded by enemies. Just then, several Israeli F-16s roared overhead, swooping into the valley and leaving their white contrails behind. Kinney stepped up to Joshua. He said in a low voice,
They're getting ready. Israel is not going to sit back and wait for Iran to make its final gambit. We'll strike first.
That realization hit Joshua like a ton of bricks. He thought about Deborah and whether it had been wise to bring her here.
Thanks for having your wife Esther spend the day with Deborah. Much appreciated.
She'll show her the sights in Jerusalem. They're having a great time, I'm sure. With their work done for the day, Joshua, Kinney, and the rest headed toward their vehicles. Just a few miles outside the testing perimeter, a small group of hikers was sitting in front of a small portable satellite monitor, watching the picture. Even though it was a little scrambled, they could make out the image of Joshua Jordan climbing into a jeep next to Colonel Kinney. One of the hikers, speaking in perfect Persian, said to his fellow Iranians,
There he is. Jordan is the civilian. See him?
Then he added,
Give the command.
Chapter 42. Iranian Airspace. Joel was at the head of the formation of Israeli F-16 fighter bombers. They were flanked by a protection squadron of F-15s. They were flying low, perilously low, at 90 feet above the desert floor. In the valley between the Caucasus Mountains, they were hoping to avoid any ground radar within a 20-mile radius. At the speed they were traveling, they would reach Iran's Natanz nuclear launch facility and drop their bombs before Iran's anti-aircraft missiles were ready to launch. They would have loved to have the new American F-35 jets, but the U.S. government balked at giving Israel the new fighters. David, flying on Joel's starboard, noticed something and laughed. Below, a goat herder, who had heard the roar of the low-flying jets and must have thought the sky was falling, was sprawling spread-eagled on the hard-scrabble ground, surrounded by his herd.
Let's hope he doesn't have a cell phone, David quipped.
Okay, final checkpoint approaching, Joel radioed back to the formation behind him. So far, the flight had been uneventful, which was surprising. Maybe this would be a repeat of Israel's bombing of Saddam Hussein's nuclear facility in Iraq in 1981. They had used a similar flight plan back then. The IAF launched a surprise attack and swept over the location, bombed it, and got out without a scratch.
Check your radar detection receivers and keep your eye on the circle on your screen for the incoming missiles nearest you.
Joel checked his flight deck clock.
Right about now, they're probably scrambling their jets.
He knew that the Iranians had the newest generation of Russian MiG fighters, but the F-15s would be able to handle them. Command had calculated the time that would be needed for the Iranians to prepare their anti-aircraft missile controls and then hone in on the incoming jets. If they were lucky.
Okay, everybody. Let's get into welded wing formation. Tighten up, folks.
The jets pulled into a near wingtip-to-wingtip position, just a matter of moments now until the strike. The large buildings of the Natanz facility came into sight in the distance.
Since most of the centrifuges and uranium enrichment equipment were underground, the F-16s were carrying super bunker busters that would crack the ground wide open and blow down deep enough to destroy everything, including the nuclear launch missiles they were told were in the adjacent silos. Joel only knew what IDF command had told him. Those in charge of the operation, like General Shapiro, had to rely on intelligence, information from people like Rafi, their own clandestine agent in Jordan, and Yosef, the Iranian insider whose motivation was unimpeachable. He needed to rescue his brother and sister from an Israeli prison. But there was something the pilots did not know, any of them. As each of the bomber pilots hit their drop buttons to let loose their deadly payload, their flight deck radar detection screens lit up. One circle, two circles, three circles. "We've been painted!" Joel cried out. "Drop and get out!" Now the sky was filled with anti-aircraft missiles, dozens of them, maybe hundreds. Joel dropped his bombs and pulled his F-16 skyward. But something, a red flash, caught his eye to the starboard. It was from the ball of fire from the missile strike that had just decimated David's F-16. No parachute, no escape. "I'm hit!" another F-15 pilot screamed over the radio. Below, Joel saw bright explosions from the fighter jets of his team being destroyed, one after another. His radar showed three Iranian MiGs fast on his tail. Everything had gone wrong. Miles away, in another part of Iran, at the nuclear launch site at Bushehr, the facility that the UN and the IAEA had declared to be safe and used only for public energy purposes, the chief of operations and his officers were cheering wildly, "Allah Akbar!" The plan had worked. Yosef and Rafi had been deliberately duped. The site at Natanz had been abandoned, and the equipment moved to tunnels in the mountains. The empty facility was a piece of dramatic stage dressing, military theater. The real nuclear launch command and the silos loaded with nuclear warheads at Bushehr were untouched. When Iranian intelligence grew suspicious that some of the local citizens in Bushehr might try to filter information to the west about the nuclear missile site, they evacuated the entire city, forcing the residents to move out. Iranian nuclear command would take no chances. The Bushehr facility was too valuable. The Iranian chief of operations smiled now as he thought of the gift of good fortune concerning the useless Israeli strike against Natanz. "Thank you, Israel. Now we can launch our nuclear warheads at you and can claim to the whole world that it was self-defense." Old City, Jerusalem. Deborah Jordan couldn't take it in fast enough. The narrow cobblestone streets, the women in head coverings peeking out of small windows, the crowds of pilgrims and tourists and merchants selling leather goods or dates laid out in trays. "I've always wanted to come here," she said. "Especially this, the Via Dolorosa. This is unbelievable. This route, the way of the cross, the path taken by Jesus on the way to the crucifixion. Almost," Deborah stammered and couldn't finish. Esther Kinney, the colonel's wife, was bright-eyed and smiling at her young visitor. "We thought you'd appreciate it." Esther stopped in the middle of the narrow street. "Now turn around and look up." When she did, Deborah recognized an ancient, graceful stone arch connecting the buildings on either side. "Now imagine," Esther said, "you are here 2,000 years ago. Make the stores and buildings disappear. Tradition says that this Roman arch is the place, or at least near the place, where Pilate appeared with Jesus. The Gospel of John makes it clear. The Roman governor had allowed Jesus to be found guilty, though he admitted there was no evidence for it. Then he ordered him to be scourged. The Roman guards mocked Jesus and rammed a crown of thorns down on his head, beat him, and laid a purple robe on his back, which had been torn open by the whip and was bleeding. Then Pontius Pilate said to those in attendance, 'Behold the man.'" Deborah was silent. Her face showed her astonishment. Esther said, "But Pilate was only half right. He forgot the other part." "Which part?" "He should have said, 'Behold the Son of God.'" Deborah smiled. "It's interesting I'm here now. This place, at this point in my life,
I've been a Christian for a while, received Christ as a teenager, but lately I've been wondering about things. My life, plans, people. People?
Well, there's this guy.
Esther laughed loudly.
Yes, there's always a guy, isn't there?
So I've got some things to work out. I need to take things to the Lord. I need some guidance.
Then she looked at Esther.
It must be hard on you, being Jewish here in Israel, as deeply involved in the government as your husband is, yet both of you also being
Messianic Christians, too?
Believing that Jesus, Yeshua, is the promised one? The once and for all sacrificial lamb offered up to take away the sins of the world for all who trust in him?
Yes, it's not been easy. But who says any of this is supposed to be easy?
It's supposed to be true and right.
Yes, it's a sensitive issue.
We handle it with discretion. Clint doesn't wear Jesus Saves t-shirts to work, if you know what I mean. Esther looked at her watch. Then she checked her cell phone.
Deborah, have you received a call from your father in the last hour?
No, why?
Oh, probably nothing. Clint usually calls about this time each day. It's a routine we have because of the way things are here. Clint and I have a joke. We say living in Israel is like the thorn trees. Lovely from a distance, but painful at close quarters. Life in Israel is beautiful, but precarious. Clint and Josh were at a remote testing site today, but should have been back by now.
Deborah pulled out her all phone and dialed her father's private number. It rang 10 times and then went to voicemail.
No answer, she said.
Deborah thought she caught something in Esther's expression, a vague look of apprehension. The next moment, Esther said,
Let's keep walking. So much to see. I know a great place for lunch.
Chapter 43. Tehran, Iran. Joshua cried out. Somewhere in his numbness and confusion, he felt searing pain. He couldn't locate it at first. His body was not on the ground. He thought he was flying. No, that wasn't it. I'm hanging. Joshua Jordan struggled to see where he was. As he did, he located the source of his torturing pain, in each of his shoulders. They were pinned behind him in hogtie fashion. He was hanging from a wall. The tips of his feet were barely touching the concrete floor. His chest had been stripped bare, and his shoes and socks were off. He blinked and shook his head, trying to clear the cobwebs.
Think back. Think back.
What happened? It started coming back. He had been climbing into the jeep with Colonel Kinney. The other members of the IDF team had already left the testing site. He remembered seeing the dust from their trucks ahead. Then from somewhere behind them, an Israeli Apache helicopter came swooping down. It landed 50 feet away. A man wearing an IDF uniform came striding out with 2 other soldiers. He said, Colonel Jordan, urgent message. The man in the IDF uniform held out a piece of paper. Joshua climbed out of the jeep as Kinney yelled to him to stop. Then one of the soldiers dropped to a kneeling position, close enough that Joshua could see the soldier was aiming a strange-looking handgun at him. Joshua turned back to the jeep. Then something struck Joshua in the back of the thigh. He grasped for it. A dart protruded from his skin. He tried to run, but the dizziness stopped him. He dragged his feet as if they were cinder blocks. Gunshots, a lot of them, were being fired. He saw Clint Kinney firing back fiercely from the ground next to the jeep, and then Kinney was hit and went down. Joshua fell into the vehicle and found the other handgun with the clip already in. He turned clumsily and started firing toward the helicopter, emptying the clip. Someone yelped in pain, but Joshua couldn't hold on. The pistol dropped from his hand. He was blacking out. The last thing he remembered was a bearded man bending over him and laughing. Now Joshua was in a concrete room hanging from a hook. There was enough light for him to get an idea of where he was. There was a drain in the middle of the floor and bloodstains. This place of cruelty had been used recently. Then he heard voices outside. One guy asked, "Haleshoma chetorast?" Another man answered something about being okay, but his wife was sick. They were making small talk. Joshua recognized the language. Persian Farsi, the language of Iran.
Years before, when he'd been running spy plane flyovers to document Iran's nuclear facilities, the Pentagon had taught him some Farsi in case he was shot down and captured. That never happened, though there was a story behind that, too. Although Josh was feeling lightheaded and woozy with pain, he found himself floating back to that distant point in time, to that last time he'd flown his newest generation U-2. He'd been alone in the bubble, thousands of feet above Iran, with only the sound of his breathing in his mask. Inhale, exhale. Then he spotted the sight. He clicked on the high-speed cameras in the belly of the aircraft. They had crystal-clear photo acuity, so that when the digital photos were downloaded, you'd practically be able to measure the size of the bolts on the girders of the nuclear plant. Then the call came in. "Hollywood 1, Hollywood 1, you've been made. Abort. Get out of there." But he didn't abort. He wanted to finish the mission. He shouldn't have made it out alive. But only later did he find out why he had. A noise snapped him out of his reverie. The metal door to the room swung open. Three men strode in. The guy in the front had a neatly trimmed beard and wore the uniform of an officer in Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard. It was the military unit that controlled Iran's nuclear weapons program. Next to him was a large soldier. "I am Captain Akbar," the officer announced. "You are our prisoner. We need some information." Another man, dressed as a civilian in a suit, stepped forward. "Colonel Jordan, the Iranian Atomic Energy Organization simply wishes to supply safe energy, electricity, modern conveniences to our people. But today, Israel bombed one of our facilities at Natanz. A ruthless act of aggression. We have the sovereign right to protect ourselves. If you can answer some simple questions, then we will let you go. You will be safely returned to your family." Joshua tried to lift his head to see the man. The civilian from the IAEO continued. "We just want some data so we can protect ourselves. Nothing more. We mean no harm," Joshua growled in a hoarse voice. "And why is there blood on the floor?" The soldier standing guard off to the side had a metal rod in his hand, and he stepped forward, but the officer stopped him. "There's plenty of time for that." The civilian asked, "Have you supplied Israel with your return to sender technology?" No answer. "I will ask it again." Again Joshua did not answer. Now the big soldier was given the go-ahead. He stepped forward and lifted Joshua's head so that he could stare him in the face. Then, smiling a wide grin, the soldier took his stick and rammed it up, butt-end, into Joshua's solar plexus. Joshua gasped for air, unable to breathe or scream in pain. Spittle ran down his mouth as he convulsed. The civilian said to the officer, "We have a tight schedule. We need this information immediately, you understand?" The officer nodded. "Don't worry. We'll get it." Hawk's Nest, Colorado. When Abigail received the call from General Shapiro in Tel Aviv, it was early afternoon, Mountain Standard Time. She vaguely knew who General Shapiro was, but her heart dropped like a brick when she heard his voice. After all these years expecting a call or a knock on the door while Josh had run dangerous missions or tested new aircraft, a call never came. But today it did. "I regret to inform you, Mrs. Jordan, that your husband has gone missing in the Negev Desert."
"Missing? I don't understand."
"His convoy was attacked. The attackers were dressed like Israeli soldiers. We believe he has been taken hostage."
"By who? Where is he now?"
"Our best intelligence is that he is now somewhere inside Iran. We believe the Iranian government is behind this."
"The American embassy? Have you contacted them? Or the Pentagon?"
"We have contacted the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency and the Pentagon."
"What are they doing about it?"
"We have every confidence that they will assist us in trying to locate and extract your husband."
Her words were trembling. "Oh, dear God, please protect my husband."
Then, in the next breath, she asked General Shapiro,
"Deborah, my daughter?"
"She's safe. She's with Colonel Kinney's wife, Esther."
"I have to get over there, General, to Israel."
"I wouldn't advise that, Mrs. Jordan."
"A rescue plan? We need one immediately."
"We're working on that. I promise we'll keep you informed, minute by minute."
Shapiro had no more information. When Abigail hung up, she stood in the middle of the big family room and shrieked Cal's name. He had been working close by outside, repairing a section of broken railing on the big wraparound porch. Now that his father was overseas, he was taking care of a few repairs that his dad had planned on doing. Cal sprinted through the front door. He found his mother with her hands over her face, shaking as she sobbed. Abigail blurted through her tears,
"Your dad's in trouble. He's been grabbed by terrorists. They think he's being held hostage in Iran."
Cal reeled and his face drained. When he caught his breath, he asked, "Who's going to get him out?"
"The Israelis are working on it, waiting to hear from Washington."
Abigail wiped her eyes and tried to take a deep breath. She and Cal locked eyes. Instinctively, they had the same thought. Cal voiced it first.
"No way, Mom. We can't wait for the politicians or the White House. They've been gunning for Dad. They'll let him twist in the wind."
"Exactly. I'm calling Rocky Bridger. He was invaluable during your crisis at Grand Central Station. How about John Gallagher?" "Can't afford to take him off task. What he's doing for us right now is critical to American security."
"So it's true, then.
What Gallagher had me researching about Russia, a nuclear threat?"
For Abigail, it all fell together. Cal's working on his computer, his desire to contribute to the roundtable effort. She offered him a simple reply to his question.
"Yes, it's true."
As she looked at her son, she knew that a convergence of circumstances had now brought him into the inner sanctum. She also knew that there were no accidents, not in a universe governed by a God who directed the destinies of people as well as nations.
"Welcome to the round table," she said.
Chapter 44. John Gallagher gunned his rental car toward Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. After getting off I-64, he streaked up Interstate 81 at 85 miles an hour. He hoped the state police were busy stopping everyone else. Ken Leary called.
"Okay, I've got into the archives, read the reports. Several spots in the valley were mentioned.
Go down the list. Geez, oh geez, I hope we're not too late." The key was to isolate the one that the Russians thought was truly a blast from the past. Gallagher and Leary agreed on one which seemed to be the best from a strategic standpoint. It was just off I-81, about 10 minutes by car from I-66, which led directly to downtown Washington. But Gallagher also knew that if he placed all his eggs in one basket and lost the bet on which basket, he was about to lose hundreds of thousands of lives, the U.S. Capitol, and most of the American government in the bargain. To make matters worse, Gallagher felt like he was doing that balancing act while running a gunny sack race.
"Thanks, Ken," he said. "Gotta go."
Gallagher fished through his private book of phone numbers until he came across a retired FBI guy by the name of Frank Trumeth. Gallagher remembered that Frank had bought a place in the Shenandoah when he left the bureau and was doing something folksy, like being a fishing guide or something. The last case they had worked together was in North Carolina, busting up a terror cell that was smuggling drugs to finance their plans to then bomb bridges in major cities during rush hour. He voice-called the number into his all-phone while driving. It rang at the other end. It kept ringing. Then he heard a voicemail.
"Hi, this is Doris and Frank. We want to talk, and so do you, so leave a message."
"Frank, hey, John Gallagher here. Retired from the bureau, just like you may have heard. How's the fishing? Say, got an emergency here. Don't want to overplay my hand, but I really, really need to talk to you ASAP. Please, buddy, give me a ring pronto, okay?"
As Gallagher flew up the interstate, he knew that Frank Trumeth was the only play he had left. Sure, Gallagher had some other backup plans if Frank was unavailable, but in the light of day, they all looked tragically stupid. For a fleeting second, he thought, "I left the FBI, so why am I still trying to save the world?" But as quickly as he asked that question, he answered it. "Because it's worth saving." Tehran, Iran. Yosef Abbas was running for his life. He'd abandoned his apartment as soon as he heard about the Israeli attack on the Natanz facility and how the whole thing had been a setup. He realized he'd been played for a pawn by the Iranian leadership. That meant that Iran's ruthless MOIS agents were onto him and would be looking for him at that very moment. He stuck to the back alleys of Tehran as he walked, trying to figure out where he could go. He had received several calls from his Israeli Mossad contact, but he didn't pick up.
Of course, no messages were left. He never trusted the Israelis completely, and now he couldn't trust anyone in the Iranian government. That left him only one option. He needed a safe house. He only knew of one place, even though he knew all the reasons why this place might spell death for him, too. He walked to an entryway off the alley, opened the blue-painted door, and climbed the stairs. At the top, he knocked three times, then twice more. The door opened. A familiar face from his university days was in the doorway. "So, Yosef Abbas," the other man said, smiling. "You finally decided to join the CDCI?" Yosef shrugged as he entered the apartment. On the wall was a poster that read, "The CDCI, Agents of Change." Underneath that, it read, "Committee for Democratic Change in Iran." A few miles from that apartment was a nondescript two-story building that had once been a warehouse. The government of Iran had converted it into a secret prison, a place for the forgotten, the forlorn, and the brutalized enemies of Iran. That was where Joshua Jordan was being held, in the third cell from the end on the second floor. His innards had been punched in with a metal rod, the bottoms of his feet beaten, and finally he had been strapped in a crude electric chair and shocked repeatedly. When they tossed him back into his cell, he was out cold for several hours. When he regained consciousness, he thought he'd been roused by someone talking to him. He was slowly aware of several voices, some talking, others yelling, all in Farsi, except one. "Colonel Jordan," the voice said, cutting through the din, and in the English of an educated Iranian. The voice had a strange nasal quality to it. "There is a bowl of water in your cell. You should take it. Be sure and hydrate. You must avoid dehydration." Joshua dragged himself slowly and painfully over to the clay bowl that had some putrid water in it. He tried to use only his hands and wrists to pull himself along because his arms felt as if they may have been dislocated, but he couldn't pick up the bowl. He lapped the stale water like a dog. The voice went on. "It seems they want you to drink water like a dog. They're trying to reduce you to a dog." With great effort, Joshua rolled over onto his side to check out his cell. It was concrete, with bars on one wall facing the hallway, and a solid metal door with some kind of small window in it. He rolled onto his back and stared at the ceiling. "You speak English?" "A lot of educated Iranians do," said the voice, which Joshua now realized was coming from a nearby cell. "Who are you?" "Dr. Hermos Abdu." "I wish you were in my cell. I need a medical doctor." "No," the man said. "I'm not that kind of doctor. Sorry." Joshua collected his strength. "How do you know who I am?"
"I hear things."
"Why are you here?"
"I am what you might call an enemy of the state, but a friend of the Iranian people."
Joshua knew he couldn't afford to trust anyone. They had tried to break him in a short amount of time, using a rapid torrent of pain. No chance for something like waterboarding. When he was flying for the Air Force, they had taught him how to endure that, but he had figured out the reason for the quick, dirty, maximum pain routine they were using. Iran was obviously planning a retaliatory strike against Israel. They needed to know the specifics of the RTS missile defense system that was in place, and they needed it quick. Joshua figured he just needed to hold on through the torture for a short period of time. On the other hand, once the attack was launched, what reason would the Iranians have to keep him alive? He thought about that, and he had already made up his mind. "I don't want to die." He had so much to live for. Now it seemed more than ever. And so much left undone. Not just his official business with the Round Table, or even his defensive weapon designs that he sincerely believed could protect innocent life. More than that, his wife, his precious Abby, and his son Cal, ever seeking to please a father who regrettably was so hard to please, and his headstrong Deb. Yet he knew there was something even beyond all of those things that he would have to deal with, a force that had been pursuing him, making him choose his course as if he were in the middle of a crossroads in a strange land. He felt he had become a kind of fugitive. But from what?
His life seemed to be closing in on him like the walls of his filthy cell.
So he needed to survive this.
But Joshua had a tactical worry. What if the Iranian Revolutionary Guard had planted this friendly prisoner, this Dr. Abdu, just to gain his confidence? Time was short. He had to take a chance. Joshua asked, "Why should I trust you?" The other man laughed, but it really wasn't from amusement, more from irony, perhaps.
"If you could see me," Dr. Abdu said, "then you would understand. Besides, Colonel Jordan, I have a secret, and it can save you."
Chapter 45. U.S. Secretary of Defense Roland Allenworth had traveled to the White House to discuss the Joshua Jordan hostage situation. He had been unable to meet with President Corland, so he was sent to the Situation Room. When he walked in, the only people there were Vice President Tolerud and Corland's chief of staff, Hank Strand. Allenworth was not pleased. "Where's the president?"
"There's been an incident," Tolerud said.
Then she nodded to Strand. The chief of staff said, "As you know, the president has been in poor health." "That's nothing new. Where is he? When can I talk to him? This can't wait."
"I'm afraid that won't be possible," Strand said.
"He's in a coma. It happened very suddenly. He passed out again. This time he didn't wake up." The look on Allenworth's face said it all. He never liked Tolerud, but she'd been a non-issue at first, particularly because Allenworth worked directly with Corland as a member of his cabinet. He had wondered sometimes why Corland had picked him. In the beginning, Allenworth had been a staunch advocate for the Pentagon, and many of his positions diverged from Corland's internationalist tendencies. But things had changed over the last year. Corland and he had begun to work well together. Allenworth had always feared Tolerud's politics, her lust for power, and her constant deference to the international community of nations. Now his worst fears were being realized. Allenworth asked the obvious question, "Do I call you Madam President?" Tolerud said,
"We will be executing the constitutional transfer of power shortly."
"Excuse my bluntness, but this needs to be done quickly. If what you are telling me is true." Tolerud's eyes glinted with an inner explosion.
"Are you questioning my honesty, Mr. Secretary of Defense?"
"No, only the medical judgment of those who say the president is unable to execute the duties of the presidency."
"Well," she snapped back, "that's not your call to make, is it?"
"I suppose not."
"What is your question, Roland?"
"It's about Joshua Jordan. The Israeli government has indicated that during a test run of the RTS missile defense system, Jordan was taken hostage and is presently inside Iran. I don't have to tell you how sensitive this situation is. Jordan possesses vital American defense information."
"You mean vital if we continue to use his RTS technology?"
"Of course."
"But not vital if we discontinue using the RTS?
"That would be a reversal of policy."
"Maybe yes, maybe no. But that is my call to make now that I will be assuming executive powers."
"But if our enemies acquire the RTS design, they could create their own return to sender laser shields."
"Well, if we don't lob missiles at them, then the RTS formula won't do them much good."
"If you'll excuse me for saying so, that would represent a preposterous approach to national defense."
"Well," Tolerud blew back, "to answer your first point, no, I won't excuse you, and secondly, I will not authorize any participation in any attempt to rescue Mr. Jordan, at least not at present. Things are much too delicate in our negotiations with Iran and Iran's partners among the Arab League to jeopardize things with some harebrained scheme to try to get Jordan out."
"What about Israel's interests?"
"What about American interests? We both know about that Israel airstrike against Iran's installations. Iran fended them off. The entire Middle East is destabilized thanks to the decisions made in Tel Aviv. And you want me to worry about Israel?"
She picked up a stack of news releases.
"You see what the Internet dailies are saying. Israel provokes Mideast war. Naked Israeli aggression. Massive strike against Iran. You want more?"
After that, Allenworth had stormed out of the White House. Now he was back at his office. He assigned his assistant secretary the distasteful task of advising the Israeli government that the United States would be unable at present to participate in any direct action to accomplish the immediate rescue of Joshua Jordan.
However, the United States will work through the Department of State to open up a dialogue with Iran and hopefully effect his release in the future. In Tel Aviv, General Shapiro received the message from the U.S. Defense Department. He could only shake his head in disgust. Israel was in a state of high alert. The mission to proactively prevent Iran from launching a nuclear attack against Israel had been a disastrous failure. Now Israel had only one option: to brace for Iran's brutal counterattack on the Israeli homeland. Israel was busy marshaling all of its military assets in hopes of stopping the inevitable. Shapiro delivered the news to the chief of staff for the Israeli Defense Forces. The chief, in turn, pulled together his strategic team for an emergency briefing. "It appears," the chief announced, "that the return to sender system may now have an even greater significance for the defense of Israel, which is interesting considering the fact that its designer is now being held hostage in a jail cell somewhere in Tehran, according to our intelligence. Should we divert our attention from the task at hand, which is the defense of our very lives, homes, and families, to rescue him? What information will he be forced to divulge if we do not? And yet, even now, the Iranians may have already extracted strategic design plans from Jordan, including the details of Israel's own version of RTS. Don't bank on that, General," a voice came from the speakerphone. It was Clinton Kinney from his hospital bed, recuperating from the two bullets that had pierced his chest, one lodging in a rib and another in his lung. "Jordan's only been in custody for a day and a half. I don't care what they've done to him up to now." The group around the table at IDF command considered what they just heard. Then Kinney added, "The plain fact is that Joshua Jordan hasn't spilled his guts to the Iranians. At least not yet. I'd bet my life on it." The last thing Abigail asked Victoria was to relay a desperate request to her husband, Pack, to get a group of trained men to New York City to stop the portable nuke attack. Victoria had called Abigail back to relay her husband's response. "Abby, it's in the works. Pack has deployed a small force of operatives to New York State as we speak. We received the expense money wired to the operations account. Thanks for that. One thing you need to know: Pack will not be considered a part of this. The Patriots are not part of this. Our men on the ground know only that you, as de facto leader of the roundtable, are the one directing and authorizing this offensive. If things go bad..." Victoria didn't have to finish the sentence. Abigail knew only too well the nightmare in store for her if this privately funded strike force of paramilitary agents was unsuccessful, or if innocent lives were lost in the attempt, or if they were just plain wrong about the threat to begin with. She was walking the outer line of treason in a desperate attempt to save her country. Now Abigail was on the phone with retired Army General Rocky Bridger. She had explained Josh's desperate situation as a captive of the Iranians. She knew this wasn't the first hostage situation Bridger had encountered. "Abigail, have you tried to reach your friend in the Patriots group about Joshua being captured?"
"Yes, I can't get through."
Abigail knew, of course, that Pack McHenry was at some unnamed location in Paris, knee-deep in surveillance of the Russian offensive. When Abigail told Rocky Bridger that the Patriots were out of the mix, Bridger had only one plan for the rescue of Joshua. "Abby, I'm going to call together some special ops guys I know. They're all out of active service now, but well-trained. Good men. If I ask them, they might just lend a hand. But I need some pretty powerful intel about where they're keeping Joshua. Maps of the area, scouting reports, structural details about the building itself." Abigail understood.
"I'm going to give you General Shapiro's international number in Israel. He's my contact. If anyone would know that information, it would be him."
Cal had been sitting next to his mother during the call. When she clicked off the phone, he opened up.
"Okay, Mom. First things first. We need to pray."
Chapter 46. Inside the metal barn in the Shenandoah Valley, Korstikov stood over the portable nuclear weapon. It was close to completion. The delicate operations involving the neutron initiator and the use of uranium deuteride as the neutron source still needed to be dealt with, but he had personally supervised Iran's development of those components. Once the initiator had been connected to the bomb, Korstikov felt satisfied it would be a work of perfection. Now they were only hours away.
The only other thing that needed to be done was to make the encrypted sat phone calls to the collaborators to the north, who were simultaneously preparing their bomb for New York City. The two teams would confirm final assembly and then coordinate the strikes so they would be only minutes apart. Even though the call should be very secure, they were taking no chances. Each had a method of making sure that no other telecommunications took place within a 15-mile radius of their positions. Their special devices would ensure absolute secrecy. When all of that was done, they would delicately load the bomb onto the truck, which would head up I-81 toward I-66, then into Washington, down Constitution Boulevard, and straight for the Capitol. The route would take the truck to a cul-de-sac at the bottom of the hill under the Capitol building, in the shadow of the Washington Monument, which was only a few blocks away. When detonated, this bomb, the bigger of the two, would send out a blast furnace shockwave with the heat intensity of the sun. It would obliterate the Capitol and all of the members of the Senate and the House of Representatives. The White House would be blown clear off the surface of the earth. All the Senate and House offices and their staffs would be incinerated instantly. The Supreme Court, the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian, and the central offices of the entire federal government would be vaporized. Much of the Pentagon, farther from Capitol Hill and closer to the Beltway, would be devastated, though there would be survivors. But America's ability to make immediate military decisions would be paralyzed. The rest of Washington, D.C., the apartment buildings, condos, shops, the glass commercial towers housing lobbying organizations, law firms, trade associations, all would be shattered and in flames. The marble monuments, Lincoln, Jefferson, Washington, would be blown into rubble. Korsakov looked at his watch. He needed to check his flight out of Dulles to make sure it was still on time. He wanted to avoid Reagan National. He had no intention of being anywhere near the blast. John Gallagher was 20 miles from the exit off of I-81 that led to the spot where he was betting the nuclear terror cell might have set up shop. He was gambling on a location designated by the KGB decades before. His all phone rang. He clicked it on. A familiar voice from the past said, "John, Frank Trumeth here. Long time." "You said it," said Gallagher. "You sound like you're in a rush." "That's putting it mildly. I got a crisis. I'm working freelance now." "Gee, John, that kind of language makes me nervous." "I'm running an outdoor shop now. Fishing gear, kayak tours. You still own guns?" "You kidding? Still know how to shoot 'em?" "Okay, what's up?" "A portable nuke has been located here in the valley."
"What?"
"I'm not kidding. Excellent intelligence on this. The feds are in total denial."
"Why?"
"Don't get me started. I just need to know if you can help."
"Who are you working for?"
"Does the name Joshua Jordan mean anything?"
"The Air Force laser guy?"
"Right. Washington doesn't trust him, but I do. He's received credible evidence of a suitcase-type nuclear device being assembled not far from you. The clock's ticking. This may have to be a citizen's arrest."
"Okay, listen, John. You're a good guy. Did some pretty gutsy stuff in your career. But here's what I heard. You were ordered into some kind of counseling because you didn't cooperate. You got pushed out of the bureau." "I'm sorry, buddy, but this whole thing sounds crazy. I don't beg well. I can't get down on my knees because I got arthritis. But if I could, I would. I'm on my knees crying like a little girl for you to help me." "What is it you want?" "I know you're connected here. I don't think the feds will get involved, or if they do, it'll be too late. I'm sure you got street cred out here in Petticoat Junction, you know, with Officer Barney Fife or whoever's the local constable. You need to round them up and get some firepower to join me at the site."
"What site?" "I have reason to believe."
"So you don't know for sure?"
"Not absolutely." Frank Trumeth groaned on the other end.
"How do I get through to you, Frank?"
Then someone, a woman in the background, was yelling something to Frank, who yelled back,
"Honey, it's John Gallagher. He's on the phone."
Then Gallagher could hear Frank's wife groaning, too.
"Oh, look, John," said Frank, "I think I need to talk this over with Sandra first. This is really way out there."
"Fine," Gallagher said. "Go ahead and talk it over, but I'm telling you, it's time to cross the Delaware. You know, we gotta stop the Hessians and save the Republic. You with me or not?"
Pause.
"Okay," Frank said.
"Whatever."
Then he hung up.
Minutes later, Gallagher saw a sign saying that his exit was 10 miles away. His esophagus was burning again. Stress. He started calculating the ludicrous stand he was about to make. One man against how many? He had his clip-loaded Beretta with him and a permit to carry. He also had his .357 Magnum short barrel with him. But these guys, if he knew anything about